Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. Online and on KBIA, I'm Ruben Stern. Do you think property taxes should be raised to fund improvements in Columbia's public schools? That's one question voters like you will face at the polls on Tuesday. A pair of proposals together could raise a property owner's annual bill by about 52 cents per $100 in valuation. To give you a better sense of what that actually means, for a home assessed at $150,000, the increase would mean an extra $148 a year in taxes. School officials say the money from the tax levy increase would help make up for gaps in state funding, while approval of the bond issue would help fund construction, including a new elementary school on the south side of town. Also on the ballot on Tuesday are two seats on the Columbia School Board and the City Council spots for the 2nd and 6th wards. Today, we've lined up two current school board members and a few Columbia-based journalists to help us better understand what's at stake in this round of voting. To start us off, Jan Mies has been a member of the Columbia Board of Education since 2007. Welcome back to our program, Jan Mies.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us today. Also from the Columbia School Board, Jonathan Sessions is a member of the school board who has served since 2010. Welcome to our studio, Jonathan Sessions.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. Our third guest in the studio today, Catherine Martin, is an education reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune. She's been following the school board candidates closely, as well as the ballot measures. Welcome to our studio, Catherine Martin.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that you and our audience will be part of the conversation today, too. How do you feel about the proposed tax increase for Columbia Public Schools? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start off with the tax levy. Jan Mies, why is the district asking voters to pay more for school operations?
Well, thanks for having us. Let me see if I can encapsulate this. First off, we've had a drastic reduction in state funding over the last number of years. In addition, the population is growing in our city, and we need to accommodate more students. We would like to be able to sustain the current programs that we have, if not enhance and improve them. We would like to maintain the lowest class size that we can afford in order to give our students a better chance at education. We want to meet individual student needs, which are continuing to be more critical. And we also want to address classroom technology needs. And I would like to let you all remember that in the last 3 years, we have cut over $20 million from our budget and 260 positions. And we need to regain some of that funding back in order to hopefully get more of our teachers back in the classrooms and keep class sizes low.
So some of this levy would bring back some of those funds that were cut out of the budget, or is this strictly to try to offset further cuts that are coming down the line?
Yes and yes.
I would say primarily, and maybe to counter your introduction, this isn't necessarily for improvements to the public schools. This is really truly to keep our base, to keep our not necessarily status quo, but to make sure that we have funding as we continue forward. As Jan mentioned, we've seen so many cuts from the state level as we've made many ourselves, that truly we see our funding continue to drop off, and we've been forecasting this, and we recognize that those reserves drop very quickly that we have. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we can continue through and keep the quality of programs that we have. At the same time, we recognize that as we've been cutting, sometimes we always come at, you know, think we're cutting as close to the bone as we can, and we're recognizing that sometimes we've nicked it in places, and it's getting difficult for educators to do their jobs. It's getting difficult for support staff to do their jobs as well, because we've maybe cut back a little too far in some places, and we're recognizing that to make sure that we're being as efficient as possible, we can shore up those places that we may have cut back a little too much.
Let me just say, the tax levy will generate $8 million additional revenue per year. But when you consider that for the last 3 years, we've cut approximately that much, we're kind of getting back to a status quo in terms of money in addition to some extra.
And when we talk about the state funding, how much of the school system's budget comes from the state?
Let's see, our local taxpayers give between 59% and 61%, and I think approximately 30% to 35% comes from the state, and then we get a small portion from the federal government. Mm-hmm. That, would you agree with that?
I think that's about
pretty quick
accurate.
Math here.
Pretty quick math, and I think the one key is it's that 30% is ever decreasing from those state numbers. It continues to decline.
Now, Catherine, you've been covering this throughout the cycle of the election. What has struck you about it? I mean, what are some of the things that are points of contention in this proposal?
Well, the argument that I've heard of people opposed to it is just that it's a hard time for everyone right now. Taxpayers are struggling with their own bills. And so that's what mostly the feedback I've been hearing.
Right. And as we decided to put this on the ballot, in addition to the bond portion of this, we had large community gatherings, and the needs were put out before this group of maybe 200 people, and they recognized the difficulty of the financial times that we are in, but they also said, you really need to move forth and get this going as quickly as you can in the hopes that it will go ahead and be successful.
Right. Again, just for our audience, I want to remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the issues and races on the ballot in Columbia on Tuesday, starting with the two proposals that would increase funding for schools. Joining me in the studio are school board member Jan Meese and Jonathan Sessions. Also with us is Catherine Martin, an education reporter for the Columbia Tribune. For those of you in our audience, have you made up your mind about how you'll vote on the school funding measures? If so, what was the deciding factor for you? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And I'd like to remind everyone that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Jonathan, you mentioned that some of those cuts have nicked some bone in terms of what is going on in the schools. What is the bone that's been cut?
Well, we see it in two different I've heard from our staff in two different areas. And the first is both of our teacher organizations made presentations to the board a few board meetings back. And the thing that we heard from both of those teacher organizations was that teachers have crowded classrooms and we've eliminated the support staff that aided them in doing their jobs. And that's when you start having more students and you have fewer support staff and fewer intervention specialists, you start to lose the ability to have more one-on-one time with students as an educator. The second place where I know we've nicked some bones is in our support staff. In our financial office, we actually had an audit done not too long ago, and it was made clear that we had too much to do and too few people to accomplish those goals. And the concern from the auditor was, you know, while everything's okay now, if you can't keep up with this amount of work, things are gonna slip. And so I know that we've made some cuts in the financial and support staff. In addition, you know, all of our schools are operating with fewer and fewer support employees, and that makes it more difficult for educators because they don't have the support staff for photocopying and all the things that they could have someone else do while they're in the classroom. It commits more time of theirs. So,
And is there, along with this levy, if it were to pass, is there a designation of that money going specifically to that specific area, or is it up to the administration to decide how the money is going to get allocated?
I know that Dr. Peter Stiepelman, our assistant superintendent of elementary education, has already been working with Dr. Belcher on the elementary side of things, which I know is part of our bigger concern when it comes to classroom size. I know that the two of them have been working out a rough plan right now as to where our highest areas of need are. But every year that kind of changes, but as populations increase and decrease at different schools. But they recognize where it is immediately, and with our forecasting that we have from our RSP, which does our demographics work. We know where those hot button areas are going to be next year, where we might have some overcrowding. So we recognize where those trends are going to happen. So Dr. Stiepelman, I know, has been working on that.
Right. Catherine?
And in addition, yeah, I was of the impression that there were maybe 25 positions that would be reinstated, not necessarily the same people, but the needs that we have identified, we need to refill those again. So.
And are those support staff positions, or are those teaching positions?
Not necessarily. They're probably a combination of both. We're not. Right. We haven't seen any definite this and this, but just a general overview number.
Catherine, are there other areas that your reporting has turned up that this money would go to help pay for specifically?
I don't think that they've really, from the tax levy, they haven't really established what that would definitely go to, but the bond issue would go for a new elementary school and then a new early childhood center, which is also supposed to help reduce the crowding at schools by taking the preschool classrooms out of the schools that have them now.
Right. Yes. So, I mean, you mentioned the bond issue. We can go ahead and move into that and kind of go back and forth, I guess, between them. The bond issue would specifically fund construction, right?
Yes.
And you mentioned an elementary school and an early childhood development center.
And they're also going to add on to existing elementary schools to help get rid of some of the trailers.
Now, trailers is something we've heard a lot about, and we heard about this the last time there was a bond issue,
yes,
right? And so people, myself included, reasonably might be a bit confused about this. Didn't we already pay to get rid of those trailers?
We have a lot of trailers. We paid to get rid of quite a few of them. The issue is that takes time. When April 2010, when I got elected, the community also passed a $120 million no tax increase bond issue.
Yeah, I think the biggest ever.
It's
right?
been the big. Right. It was the biggest
the
ever,
state, right.
And no tax increase, and the majority of those funds were dedicated to the opening of the construction of Battle High School. The opening of Battle High School and the reorganization of the secondary program from a 6th, 7th grade in middle school, 8th, 9th in junior high, and 10th, 11th, 12th in high school to a 6th through 8th middle school and a 9th through 12th high school program will eliminate roughly 50 to 60 trailers in the district. So we're working on...
We're down to 100.
So that takes us down to about 100, but that'll be in August 2013. When we start opening... As we have a 10-year facility and bond plan, which we've been distributing to the community, this next bond issue is the first step in catching up on our elementary side. We'll have eliminated, with the opening of Battle High, all of our trailers at the secondary level. When we look at our elementary level, we still have about 90 to 100 that'll be left. And this 10-year facility bond plan eliminates the trailers at the elementary level by about 2020. So we recognize that we've made promises, and those promises are being kept, but we first didn't get all $120 million right up front, and even if we did, it takes time to build a high school, so it takes time for us to get rid of those
trailers. Let me just clarify what you just said there for a second. So if this passes, then you're saying that the school board would not be asking for any more facilities construction bonds through 2020, and that
no,
we would no longer have
no,
to
no, I want to make that clear.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand what you said there.
We have a 10-year facility bond plan that takes us through April 2020, and that actually includes, in April 2014, another bond issue that would be about $50 million. We're looking somewhere between 6 to 8 cent tax increase at that time. That would include another new elementary school, as well as about three other expansions to our inner city schools. We're talking about Grant, Benton, and Lee Elementaries would be a part of that April 14 bond issue. But with the bond issue tomorrow and the bond issue in 2014, that puts the Columbia Public Schools in a great financial position to ask the voters for about a $40 million bond issue in April 2016 and another $40 million bond issue in April 2018 that would be of no tax increase to the voters.
And then I would like to point out that since the early 90s, we have not asked for any increase in the tax rate for the bonds. We've been subsisting on 80 to 81 cents of our total tax levy to continue with building improvements and growth. And now it's just come to the point where that 80 cents isn't going to cover it all. So the 12 cents would increase it. And then another 6 to 8 cents, again, would bring that up to a really pretty stable level. And we actually could have our bond fund be up to $1.30 of our tax levy, but we have always kept it as low as we can.
Right. So just to clarify for a second there on the that question of kids in trailer classrooms, in order to eliminate all of those by 2020 and get kids into brick-and-mortar schools all across the district, that would require this bond issue to pass and other bond issues over the next several years, probably every 2 years going up to that.
That is absolutely correct. And I think that's what Jan touched on, the fact that we've kept our capital, our debt service levy so low. It's put us in a place that created the situation with trailers. We haven't been able to catch up on construction. And that's one of the reasons why we have 100 trailers. We've never been in a financial place to not only catch up to eliminate trailers, but also keep up at the same time with the growth that we're seeing in Columbia. We're a community that folks want to live in, and we're glad to be one of the reasons why folks want to come to Columbia. But at the same time, that growth is very rapid, and we need to make sure that as a school district, we're prepared to keep up with that growth. And at the same time, eliminate these trailers, which are not only poor classroom environments, but also a financial burden to our district.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Joyce is on the phone. Joyce, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, Joyce, thanks for joining our program today and for calling in.
I appreciate you having me with a question here.
Yeah, we're glad to get you in the conversation. What's your question or comment today?
Well, they're talking about the class size. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know what the average class size is right now in the Columbia School District for classes 1 through 3, and then for grades 4, 5, and 6, what the class size is right now, average class sizes in the junior high, and what's the ideal?
That's a good question.
Joyce,
do you happen to have some of those statistics?
We have the printout on that, my dear. Let's see if we can help you.
This is not a setup.
We do not know you, Joyce. We're happy to answer your
question. Joyce, we'll send you the check later.
Our school board members came with a stack of paperwork today, and that they're going to read some of that.
We've been studying.
I'll take it off of the air.
Okay. Thanks again for calling in, Joyce.
Joyce, thank you. Looking at what we've got here, we have
elementary
schools. The majority of our classrooms are at the desirable level, and desirable level for grades K through 2nd. I'm sorry, I'm going to cut this up differently than you requested, but this is how DESE gives us, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education gives us these. Kindergarten through 2nd grade, 20 to 24 kids in a classroom. Grades 3rd through 4th, 22 to 26th grade, and 5th grade, 25 to 29.
And those are the ideal numbers.
Those are the ideal. They call them desirable. And we have well over the majority of our classrooms in that area or better than desirable. In this year, we have roughly 23 classrooms that are desirable or better than desirable. And we only have 27 classrooms that are larger than state standards.
And that's at what grade level is that?
Elementary.
That would be
K
elementary. And I will say that we have, in those areas where we have larger than state standards, I know that Dr. Stiepelman, who I mentioned earlier, has intervention specialists as well as teacher aides in those classrooms to help those teachers with the larger class sizes. And I also want to point out that these numbers are from actually October of last year. I know we've made some hires to help reduce that number of 27.
So the vast majority of students at the elementary level are in classes that are at the ideal size
that
or
is
smaller.
Absolutely correct.
So it's a question of trailer versus brick and mortar. It's not necessarily a question of overcrowded classrooms at this point.
That is correct.
Okay.
But we're seeing an increase in these numbers. And on the secondary level, let me go to that. The desirable class size is 28 or below, like 27. And this year, we have a projection of approximately 15% of our secondary classrooms are over that magic number of 27, 28. So, and that has increased from 2009 to 2010, almost a 5% increase in the number of classrooms that are overcrowded at our secondary level.
So, what I will say is at the secondary level, you often have classes that are group classes or larger classes like choir and band. And sometimes those classes can skew these numbers because choirs can be in upwards of 70, 80 people. And that can often skew these numbers, but they are low, but we'd love to have them lower.
Okay. I want to remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the issues and races on the ballot in Columbia this Tuesday. So far we've been talking about the issues related to public schools in Columbia. Joining me in the studio are school board members Jan Mees and Jonathan Sessions. Also with us is Catherine Martin, an education reporter for the Columbia Tribune. For those of you in our audience, if you have a child attending school in Columbia, what do you see as the priority area that school administrators ought to focus on? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Catherine, I'm wondering what else about these ballot issues are the public talking about or other people that you're interviewing for your reporting?
I think some of the common concerns come from misconceptions about how school finances work. And school finances are difficult to understand. And a lot of people ask why the district's asking for more money when they haven't finished air conditioning projects. And so Jonathan explained that a little bit before, that they don't get all the money right away. They still don't have all the money from the 2010 bond. And the money, if it's approved for this year, they won't get it until 2014. And so that's been a common concern I've heard.
Right, that they ask for money and then the products don't get finished.
Can't spend it, that we can't get it ready to be spent that quickly due by federal regulations as to how many bonds we can have out there at any one particular time.
So what sort of time frame would the community be looking at with this particular bond issue? So, an elementary school, early childhood learning center, when would those happen?
Well, we're looking at the new elementary school. Well, I think we need to make sure that we're very clear. We have a new elementary school on the books, which was a part of the April 2010 already approved bond issue that we would expect to open, as Jan says, here in 2015. That's the one that's going to be out by Battle High School.
Mm-hmm.
The April 2012, the bond issue that's on the ballot tomorrow, that elementary school is slated to open roughly August 2016. So, again, this is we understand the complication here is often a matter of the time span. We have to operate in these, we're looking at approving something tomorrow that wouldn't be completed for 4 years at best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Our early childhood center would be slated for about August 2017. We're looking at long-term plans here. Again, this is an April 10-year facilities plan. So we're talking about very long-term.
And if we could step back to Catherine's comments about people commenting on the air conditioning,
mm-hmm.
By the end of this summer, all of our elementaries will be air conditioned, and now we're working on the design plans for Jeff Jr. and Wes Jr., which are extremely complex, especially the Jeff Jr. design, because the building is 100 years old, and what's the ductwork like in that kind of a building? But that is slated to be completed by 2014, as I recall,
I think that's about right. And it's very complicated because, as Jen said, part of that building's 100 years old, part of that building's 50 years old, part of that building's 20 years old, so you have a lot of compound issues with air conditioning
in those
older buildings.
And that's not an excuse. It's just an explanation that perhaps people aren't aware of.
Okay. Before we run out of time before our break, I want to talk a little bit about the race going on for two of the city, the school board the school board seats. We've got council candidates coming up later in the program. I'm getting a little confused there. There are two seats on the board that are open at this point. One of the board members has decided not to run for re-election.
Yes.
Catherine, can you walk us through a little bit about some of the candidates and the things that are being talked about in that race?
Sure. the four candidates, there's the incumbent, Christine King, and there's also Paul Cushing, Melvin Blaze, and Rex Cohn. And one of the biggest issues that the candidates have been asked about is their feelings on the bond and levy, and they all support the bond and levy. Paul Cushing actually came into the race opposed to the levy, and that was his platform for joining. And after spending time in schools and talking with administrators, he now has voiced support for the levy and the bond issue. They've talked about teacher salary, and Melvin Blaze is in favor of merit-based pay, which gives teachers raises based on performance in the classroom and things like test scores and other factors. And Paul Cushing is also voiced support for that. Rex Cohn has been the only one to say that the district should definitely make up the missteps on the salary schedule from when they had a salary freeze. And Christine King has talked a little bit about that, and she said it comes down to a bigger issue of if they want to make up the missteps or overhaul the salary schedule, which is how they pay their teachers and how they figure out raises.
Right. Are there other points of differentiation in terms of these candidates? I mean, they all agree on the bond issue. They all agree on the levy increase. So it just that teacher salary issue seems to be the only thing, or are there other ways that these candidates are distinguishing themselves?
Yes, that's the big one. Paul Cushing stands out because he doesn't have children in the school system. He doesn't have so he's just representing taxpayers and coming in from that standpoint. Rex Cohn's wife she's a teacher at Rockbridge High School. And he also has children in the district. And Christine has children in the district as well. And then Melvin had children in the district, and they're all grown now.
Right.
And he comes from the university.
And is that the usual case, that people on the school board have kids in schools, and that's why they're on the school board?
I may be the person that stands apart there. My background's in education, which is one of the reasons why I chose to run for the school board. But actually, I have no children in the district and have not had children in the district. And up until recently, I wasn't even a homeowner. So I definitely had a different representation than you typically see on the school board. Mm-hmm.
And I think the majority of people have had at one time students. I mean, I had students in the district. Now I have grandkids. But you don't often, there seems to be more people who have had experience with the schools, and that kind of gets them hooked on why they're intrigued and wanting to serve. And I do want to, congratulate all the candidates on running, because it's a tough job to run for public election, and their interest in the schools is to be commended.
And what was the toughest thing for you two once you actually did get elected?
Oh, a huge learning curve.
It's massive.
And I thought I knew a lot because I'd worked for the district for 20-some years, but it's a lot different from the administrative side than from the teaching side of the table.
I would agree 100%. I think you look at Mr. Cushing, who came to the race opposed, and is as he's begun to recognize the complications and financing and just how complicated public school financing is, he changed his opinion on that. And I think that was exactly what my perspective was as well, is as prepared as you can possibly be coming into this. And I felt that I was very prepared.
Yeah.
And I'd spent a lot of time doing research on this, but you quickly realize that there's, once you get over one hill, there's a mountain on the other side.
Okay, I got to dive in and remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the issues and races on the Columbia ballot this Tuesday. I'd like to thank school board members Jan Meese and Jonathan Sessions for joining us in the studio. After the break, we'll be back to talk about the city council races with Catherine Martin and her colleague Andrew Denny, as well as Columbia, Missourian reporter Kip Hill. So stick around, and we'll be right back after this break. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the issues and races on the ballot in Columbia this Tuesday. Before the break, we talked about the issues related to schools, and now we're going to move on to the city council races. Candidates in Columbia are vying for seats in the 2nd and 6th wards of Columbia. Joining me to talk about those races, Catherine Martin is still with us here in the studio. She's an education reporter for the Columbia Tribune. Thanks for continuing in our conversation, Catherine.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you all throughout our program today. Also with us today, Andrew Denny is a city government reporter for the Columbia Tribune. Welcome back to our show, Andrew Denny.
Thanks for having me back, Ruben.
Glad to have you back. And we also have on the phone today, Kip Hill. He is a public life reporter for the Columbia Missourian. Kip, are you with us?
I am, sir. Thanks
Great.
For having me on. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
For calling in and joining us. And as always, we hope that you and our audience will join the conversation as well. What issues do you think are the most important in the 2nd or 6th ward council election? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'll go ahead and get started. Let's talk about the 6th ward race first, because that one seems pretty interesting. And Andrew, I'm going to let you start us off here. This race has been a little different from some of the ones we've seen in the past. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why it is that it's a little different.
It's an understatement to say that it's been a bit contentious. Local elections, a lot of candidates and running in the local arena pride themselves on not running, very contentious, somewhat negative campaigns. The fact of the matter is this isn't the first time that a city council race has gotten a little bit, a little fractious. I'll just focus on this one first. There was a perception going in among the business community that Councilwoman Hoppe doesn't represent their interests on the council.
What, and that's the incumbent, Barbara Hoppe.
The incumbent, two-term incumbent, Barbara Hoppe. There was a perception among Bill Tillotson's backers in the race that he would promote the interests of the business community a little more to their liking. That's a matter of opinion. I'm not saying that one could do it more effectively than the other, but it's a matter of perception.
Right. And so that has played out in terms of the advertising that's gone on. We have one of the ads that we I want to play a little bit of the clip and we can talk about what's going on there and how that is representative. So why don't we go ahead and roll a bit of the clip here and then we can talk a little bit about it.
Barbara Hoppe says she's for transparency.
But not when she's involved with a $100,000 payoff and cover-up.
Hoppe took sides with her political donors against students.
Hoppe used her official power to stop a fraternity building project until she and her buddies could squeeze a $100,000.
Okay, so it sounds and looks a lot like the kind of things we see in a presidential race, right?
Yes.
Where did this come from? What's going on here? It doesn't feel like Columbia politics.
If you're trying to ask whether or not this is indicative of a larger trend in local politics, that I couldn't say, but I could speak to what exactly the background behind this ad.
That'd
is.
Be great. Help us understand that.
It comes from the Beta House, the new Beta House at 520 South College Avenue. The city building inspections office, they had an oversight when the plans were submitted by the architect. It was being built 7 feet too tall. There were some members of the East Campus Neighborhood Association, or perhaps just East Campus residents, that noticed the height of the building. I started asking questions when the city planning department found out that it was indeed being built 7 feet too tall for its zoning designation. The talks began. Craig Van Matry, a local attorney who represents the Beta House, entered into negotiations with the East Campus Neighborhood Association. These ads have called the settlement that eventually came out of that was paid to the East Campus Neighborhood Association. It's being called a secret payoff. It's oversimplifying it just a little bit. There was a confidentiality agreement signed between the parties in that. Whether the negotiations were going on, that wasn't a secret. It was the details within those talks that were kept from coming to light. There was also a claim of a $100,000 cash settlement paid to the East Campus Neighborhood Association. Once again, that's not something I've confirmed, but this is something that the ad is using. And once again, the confidentiality agreement is preventing the parties from telling me when I ask the question whether or not that is indeed true. So, to make a long story short, Scott Charton, a former Associated Press reporter who is volunteering his skills to help the Tillotson campaign, he did some digging. He was able to get some himself and another and an East Campus resident were able to get some records from the city, some emails between Councilwoman Hoppe and some of her supporters and with city staffers. You know, and in talking back and forth about this issue, there was a perception that she was using pressure to move things along in terms of getting city staffers to take some action on the issue. As you might remember, the city council actually voted back in November to halt construction on the new Beta House. There was a within some of the reports that Scott was able to turn over to various members of the local media. As I said, there was a perception that Councilwoman Hoppe was using her position to sort of move things along a little more quickly. Basically work on behalf of East Campus Neighborhood Association members who have given her campaign money right. to work on their behalf rather than students of the Beta House as portrayed in the ad.
Right. Kip, I want to give you a chance to weigh in here as well. You've been covering the same race, right?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. So provide your own analysis of this. We've heard a lot of the details behind that specific ad. Mm-hmm. What's your take on all this?
Well, I've been Mr. Denny gave a very accurate synopsis of what was occurring there, and it has been a very delicate issue. In terms of the one thing that I would add to what Mr. Denny said was another charge that was included in this document provided by Mr. Charton, or another accusation that came out was that Ms. Hoppe was using her position on the council to obtain records free of charge related to the construction of the Beta House for members of the East Campus Neighborhood Association. And that was an interesting point that was brought up in a editorial by Mr. Waters for the Tribune. It's just looking at the issue, I guess the perception that's kind of come out, and, obviously this is the kind of ad that will divide the electorate and put them behind whichever candidate they choose to support. I guess, the backers of Hoppe would say that, these are not only lies, that they, cast the, they present the facts of the case in a certain tone. Whereas, the backers of Tillotson would say that this raises a lot of interesting questions about, how a council person uses their position on the council to kind of move things forward as Mr. Denny alluded to. So I guess, The main thing that kind of resulted from that, we put out a story in the Missourian the next day that cited some of the materials brought to us by Mr. Charton, and there was a large amount of readership, much larger than any story I've produced for the Missourian in my brief time here, and a lot of comments. So I think, after the fact, Mr. Tillotson came out and said this ad is backed up by facts. The work of Mr. Charton, and it also was designed to get folks talking. And if the comments section of our website and then the Tribune's website is any indication, that is what has occurred.
Right. So. We have a comment from our online chat room here. Tillotson is backed by the Columbia Chamber of Commerce, right? And in mm-hmm. previous races, the last city council election was the first time that the Chamber of Commerce actually came out and endorsed an entire slate of candidates. The question from the chat room is this, and I'm reading this from our chat room, is it just me, or are these dirty local campaigns always the ones endorsed by the Columbia Chamber of Commerce? That's the question from our commenter. I'm going to throw that to our reporters here. How do you respond to that?
Well, dirty, I mean, that's that's once again, I keep using the term matter of perception. They certainly get fractious. There's certainly a a certain us versus them mentality that gets injected into races where the chamber has inserted itself and given its endorsement to a candidate. I'm thinking about not so much the race of the election of Mayor Bob McDavid in 2010, the fourth ward race for which Daryl Dudley was the eventual victor. There was a bit of contention there. It was more so in the third ward race between now Councilman Gary Kespel and former Councilman Carl Scala, that was the second time they'd actually ran against each other. In the following year, 2011, once again, the chamber interjected itself.
That's right.
And interjected itself into the fifth ward race between Helen Anthony and Glenn Earhart. And once again, there was some contention. I remember the candidate forums for that race, and it was first ward and fifth ward at the same time. First ward, they all appeared very, very cordial to each other, very friendly, but Ms. Anthony and Mr. Earhart were more apt to disagree on certain issues. I can't speak to races before 2010 when before the chamber started doing these endorsements, but I will say that the races they have interjected into have not exactly been extremely friendly, I would say.
Kip, would you agree with that polite language?
Well, I just point out that the Chamber of Commerce also supported Mr. Bill Pauls in the second ward council election, and that race has remained generally congenial as it has progressed. So, there is that it seems to be that perception out there that maybe the support of business or what have you can lead to these fractional type of elections. But I would point out that they've also supported Mr. Pauls, and that race has remained relatively calm compared to what has occurred in the last couple of weeks in the sixth ward.
Okay. Catherine, I want to give you a chance to join in here. You've covered a lot of the school board forums where these candidates have appeared as well.
Yes.
What's your sense of the way that they're going about campaigning against each other?
There's definitely a major difference in the sixth ward and the second ward. They actually addressed this specifically at the Keep Columbia Free sponsored a forum last week. And the sixth ward candidates shook hands and talked about how they don't always agree, but there's not so much negativity in their campaign. And you could tell that there were more tensions in the second ward race, or in the sixth ward race. Uh-huh. Sorry,
Andrew, you were going to weigh in.
I was going to basically agree with Kip and Catherine on that. There was almost a certain hamminess between the second ward candidates the last forum that they'd all sort of been sharing this experience of trying to win over the voters of their ward. There was like backslapping and handshake. I mean, they appeared that. Three guys who got along rather well, as ideologically opposed as they might be on some issues.
Okay, I want to remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the issues and races on the ballot in Columbia on Tuesday. Joining me in the studio are Columbia Tribune reporters Andrew Denny and Catherine Martin. And on the phone we have Columbia, Missourian reporter Kip Hill. For those of you in our audience, if you have questions or comments about the race, we hope you'll join our conversation here as well. You can give us a call at 882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. In addition to the way they're campaigning, what exactly are the issues facing these wards? Let's start with the sixth ward. What's going on in the sixth ward that people are or should be concerned about in deciding who's going to represent them?
I would say that it's issues of land use and development. And Mr. Tillotson in recent weeks has pointed out certain policy matters, certain things that Councilwoman Hoppe has voted on that I believe that he thinks might have maybe should have been done differently. There was a bridge on McGuire Boulevard down in some of the southern Columbia development that she voted against initially, and he said he would have done things differently in that instance. And it's very generally been issues of development. Mr. Tillotson has called himself a pro-growth candidate that could maybe look at things a little bit more with a business sense, a sense of bringing jobs to the community rather than worrying so much about environmental impact.
Right. Kip, what are you hearing in terms of the issues in the sixth ward?
Well, you know, a lot of the same types of things. I think economic development and land use is one of the major areas where at least Mr. Tillotson is attempting to portray himself as a different candidate than Ms. Hoppe. And I think tied into that, and this is, you know, something that a lot of voters that are people that have commented and those kind of things have chatted with me about is the use of the enhanced enterprise zones and other tax abatements to bring jobs to Columbia. And that's something that's, you know, citywide. It's not just a Sixth Ward issue. All of the candidates that we talked to at the Missourian responded to that. And I think in another thing in the Sixth Ward is the transit issue. That's something that Ms. Hoppe's ran on this year, just her attention to those specific issues and getting students to and from campus in ways that don't cause traffic gridlock and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, that's an issue that I believe, you know, Ms. Hoppe and Mr. Tillotson probably are closer together on in support of the mayor's recommendation that the system be more student-centric and that the costs be shared among different entities in town. So those are the main things that we've been talking about and that we found in chatting with the candidates and people in the Sixth Ward.
Right. And what's the claim against Hoppe? I mean, didn't she vote for the economic enterprise zones?
She voted to the council actually voted unanimously to establish the board. When I spoke with Ms. Hoppe a week or two ago, she mentioned that process of approving that board may have occurred too quickly, that, you know, right now they're working on establishing the boundaries of these zones and kind of figuring out what the definitions mean and that kind of thing. And I guess, you know, obviously there's been a concern among the public about usage of the term blight and how that would lead to eminent domain in the community or may or may not be used. And I think that's something that all of the candidates are aware of and want to make sure that they're moving forward with this whole enhanced enterprise zone properly. You know, if they're should they be in favor of establishing an enhanced enterprise zone in the
right.
city.
Right. I mean, we've talked a little bit about how Tillotson is positioning himself. How is Hoppe positioning herself in this race? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, at her campaign events and in speaking with me about, you know, just campaigning in general, one of the major goals that she has had is reminding folks what she's done in her past 6 years on the council and, you know, different initiatives that she's supported. So, you know, she described it to me as a process of just going around and reminding people of the facts. And I think that those efforts were redoubled, in wake of the ads that came out and her supporters' perceptions of falsehoods in those ads, or at least, telling the facts in a way that fits a narrative that helps Mr. Tillotson's campaign as opposed to, what she believes occurred, I guess.
Okay. Anything else to add, Andrew?
I would just say that when you're talking about local elections, it oftentimes can be a little bit difficult to make everything a two-sided issue. When you're talking about the state and national levels, there's a lot of social issues that, you know, I'm pro-choice or pro-life, et cetera, that, you know, that can divide people a lot more easily, and sometimes with local issues. I mean, like, for example, I don't want to cast Councilwoman Hoppe as anti-development or you know, Mr. Tillotson to be anti-environmental, you know, anti-environmental concerns. That can make it a little difficult sometimes to parse out, I guess, where everyone stands. Councilwoman Hoppe has told me that, you know, she, you know, economic development is good for the city, you know, and while keeping environmental concerns in mind, moving forward on those things, she might take a little bit different of a approach with Mr. Tillotson. So yes, I guess it'd be a little bit difficult to answer that question in a very clear and concise way. So
yeah, it's the kind of nuance that is often hard to get into a 30-second spot, right?
Exactly. So,
Catherine, any other thoughts on the Sixth Ward race from your vantage point?
No, I think that they covered it pretty well.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about the Second Ward race. Andrew, you said that those candidates are a lot more sort of collegial, I guess would be a word to describe that. Talk a little bit about what the points of difference are then, why a voter might choose one of those candidates over another.
As I said before, while they seem to get along pretty well, very little argument between the three of them, they do have different viewpoints. They come from different backgrounds, different approaches. Mike Atkinson, co-owns the candy factory here downtown. He is kind of, he described himself to me as a moderate libertarian. And it that kind of came out to me in some of the forums, some of the ways he was describing accountability for the police department and certain taxing issues on the Enhanced Enterprise Zone program. For example, he seemed to cast a lot of skepticism on it as a tax credit program. Bill Pauls, I would almost dare say he could be considered an establishment candidate if I could use such a label. He was endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce as well, as Kip pointed out, and he has spent some time, I believe 9 years now, with the Parks and Recreation Commission. There was a forum actually that Catherine covered, held by the Mule Skinners, the Democratic Club in town, where the issue of abortion and contraceptives for women came up. And he really, which it was kind of, I would say, not, he went ahead and took the pro-life position when asked about it. And it's a little bit rare, I would say, for local candidates to sort of dive into such a large divisive issue. But I believe he sort of cited his involvement with Our Lady of Lourdes Parish.
Yes, he said he's Catholic and he goes to Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yeah, he was his devout Catholicism was brought up in that issue. And finally, Michael Trapp. Michael has he's garnered a lot of support from progressive voters in the race. A lot of folks who gave money to Councilwoman Hoppe, for example, have also donated to Michael Trapp's campaign. He wanted to stress to me when I spoke with him last week that he's not a far left liberal by any means, but he wanted to try and avoid going using the political labels, but I would say that's sort of a quick rundown of the differences between them. So,
okay, Kip, anything to add to that?
Well, I think that's a really good summation, I think, of their policy positions and personalities. I would say that Mr. Pauls, being one of the three candidates, and he would tell you this rather frequently in his campaign, that is the only retired person on the ballot, whereas Michael Trapp and Mr. Atkinson are both employed at the moment. Mr. Pauls says that he's going to commit as much time as necessary to the job and won't have any other types of distractions. But I think, in terms of community support, or support from community groups here in town, it's kind of been, spread out in this race. As we said before, as Mr. Denny and I said, Mr. Pauls has attained the endorsement of the Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Trapp received a donation of funds from labor groups here in town, and Mr. Atkinson just recently received the endorsement of Keep Columbia Free, as Mr. Denny and Ms. Martin told you there. So I think that there's a lot of things that they're similar on, or they have similar views on. But I would say I would agree with Mr. Denny that there are major, also some policy things that they diverge on, and they obviously have some personality differences as well.
Right, Kip, are there issues that are specific to the second ward that are different from the things that affect the rest of the city?
Well, in answer to that question, I guess I would refer to Mr. Thornhill, the outgoing council member, when he was electing not to consider re-election or run again. I believe it was in the Tribune that he was quoted as saying that, I might be paraphrasing here, but that the second ward was kind of apathetic. And that was something that Mr. Trapp has kind of leaned on and made a point of in saying that's the reason that I wanted to run. And I think all of the candidates would tell you that neighborhood issues, sidewalk, infrastructure are things that need to be addressed in the second ward. There's also been a spike in property crime, I believe, in certain areas of that ward. So I would say that specifically related to that ward, I would, neighborhood concerns and things of that nature are probably what the candidates have talked about the most in the lead up to the election.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, you're nodding.
Yeah, that definitely sounds right. And I'll Michael Trapp actually made a pretty good observation about the second ward. He had said in all the door knocking that he's done, and that he found that a lot of second ward residents are they're young families is what he really stressed. And he had said himself, and I might add that Michael Trapp literally kind of came out of nowhere for this race. It was when I'd heard he was running, I was like, who? So he hasn't served on any city boards and commissions, as far as I know. Civic groups he hasn't been involved with, but he said himself that he's been involved with how he put it was his life tasks, that he was busy with his work in social services, and that local government wasn't something that he thought too much about. He'd said that he met a lot of families like that in the second ward, that they just are, they're busy with working, they're busy doing school, they're busy with their children, what have you. I mean, whether or not you could consider write off an entire ward as apathetic, that remains to be seen. However, the way you put it, there does seem to be a certain disconnect between residents there and what's happening downtown at City Hall.
And have any of the candidates offered a strategy for how they might engage those residents who are otherwise busy kind of getting on with life?
I can't say that I've heard anyone kind of come up with a remedy for it, but I guess we could see what ideas could trickle out once we determine who exactly is going to be sitting in the second ward seat.
Right. Catherine, anything to add about what you've seen from the candidates in the second ward?
I did cover the forum, and I did talk with a couple of second ward residents there, and there are, I think Kip mentioned it, there are some people with concerns about sidewalks and crime along Business Loop 70. And so there are people in the second ward who are looking for someone to address those specific issues.
Right. In terms of the second ward voting, I mean, do you have a sense of what the turnout might be, or whether these candidates are mobilizing people who might not otherwise usually go to the polls?
Well, with the second ward, looking back at the last, everything that was featured on the Boone County Clerk's website, I believe it's back to the early 2000s. 2009 was a low turnout. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,100, 1,200, the actual number, but it's in that area. But I will say that was a bad year for voting altogether. 2009 was a pretty historically low voting turnout for a lot of different races. It was, Boone County Clerk Wendy Noren described it as voter fatigue after a huge race in 2008. Who really cares? I guess who wants to drag themselves to the polls after that? I don't know if that's what everybody thought, but that was sort of her take on it. So it's hard to kind of compare what could happen this year with that election. And in the elections in the second ward that preceded that, you had a longtime incumbent in Christopher Yonku, who, when you have a longtime incumbent, sometimes voting can kind of ratchet down because, as described, I talked to somebody from the second ward in an article about this, that everyone just sort of expected Chris Yonku to win. So why go rushing to the polls?
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to end our conversation there. I'd like to thank our guests today, school board members Jan Meese and Jonathan Sessions, and also Columbia Tribune education reporter Catherine Martin. Thanks also to Columbia Tribune reporter Andrew Denny and Columbia Missourian reporter Kip Hill. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Our audio producer is Pat Akers. Executive producers Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.